And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing. My name's Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We are broadcasting from the studios of KUCI FM at the University of California, Irvine. You'll find us on the dial, if there are still radio dials out there, at 88.9 FM. You can listen also on the web at kuci.org. Today is Wednesday, September 11th. 2019. If you'd like to email me, I'd like to hear from you. Email penonfire@earthlink.net. I'd love to know what you think of the show, good or bad, authors that you would like to hear from, and whatever else you have to say. We are interested. I don't think I've ever done a little survey, and this is sort of my little survey. So write to me. I will write back to you. You can also subscribe to the show at iTunes or Stitcher. And when we upload a show, which is generally a few days after broadcast, it will arrive in your podcast file. And yeah, today's 9/11. I have to say something about that. It's the 18th anniversary, 18 years. I spent a good while this morning looking up poems written after 9/11, and if we have time, I will read one before the break by one of my all-time favorite poets. But I was thinking, especially since we have Georgiana Marie coming on in just a minute or so, and she has a book for writers, Improv for Writers, this might be a writing prompt for you writers out there today who need a prompt. It could be, where were you on 9/11, 2001, when you heard the news? Start with the weather. For me, it was much like today, sunny, clear. I had just dropped my son off at school. I think he was in kindergarten. And I was got back in the car and was tuning in NPR when the news came on. I sat in the parking lot beside a playground. No one was in the playground. And so on. I had to write about it 18 years ago, and I wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times that's on my website under writings. And there's still more to say about that day, especially if that day has meaning for you as it does for me. Write about it. Writers are the recorders of history, and if we don't write it, who will? Let's bring on our guest. Georgiana Marie is an award-winning actress, stand-up comedian, playwright, screenwriter, and improv instructor. Her book is Improv for Writers, 10 Secrets to Help Novelists and Screenwriters Bypass Writer's Block and Generate Infinite Ideas. Let's bring her on. Hi, Georgiana.
Hi, Barbara. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Great to have you. Let's start by having you introduce the book and how it came about.
So yes, the book is called Improv for Writers, and it's 10 Secrets to Help Novelists and Screenwriters Bypass Writer's Block and Generate Infinite Ideas. And I love improv and improvisation, and have found it to be a very fun and useful tool in a lot of different ways, and it works for writing too, without having to get up on stage. Like, there's a lot of power with practicing improv and doing it repeatedly, and I've discovered that writers can tap into that in their own way, and that's what the book is. It's a lot of games and a lot of the ideas behind improv, the rules of it, you might say, that not everybody knows about. So they're just kind of laid out for writers to use.
So I'm curious, because you do so many things. You're an actor. You narrate audiobooks. You're a voice actor. You're a writer. What came first?
Well, that's a good question. I wanted to be a writer long before I wanted to be an actor, and I wrote long before I started performing. And in fact, when I performed for the first time in high school, I was like, uh-oh, because I really liked it. It was, I really liked making people laugh, and I had been in a Neil Simon play, and that was sort of what happened in high school. And, kids are mimics, and that's how I ended up in the play was just mimicking somebody else that I saw audition. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to do what she's doing, which is actually one of the rules of improv is one of them is be an expert. So just deciding you can do something and you can do it well by just deciding. And a lot of scenes and things take place on stage with an actor just doing that. And, you know, because if somebody makes them a neurophysicist, it's like you can't stand there and say, I don't know what that is and where do I begin? You just say, hand me the scalpel, which you don't do as a neurophysicist. But it can, you know, that leads you down another road and, you know, becoming the worst neurophysicist in the world, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's been said a million times, writers have fear of the blank page. And I think writers have fears all along the way. And, you know, you have a draft, you hit the revision phase, and there's more fear. I'm curious, so like you use the timer, which I've been an evangelist for the timer in writing for years and years. And I'd love to hear you talk about why the timer is important.
This book actually wouldn't work without the timer. When I was looking at the possibility of, because I did this as a workshop first at Scriptwriters Network, it's a nonprofit organization here in Los Angeles. And I had pitched this idea when I was at Comic-Con to Melissa, the founders there, and she runs the company. And I pitched the idea to her, and then I was like, well, now how am I going to pull this off? Because I've taught improv for so long, and I've taught improv to one person for, you know, we did a whole program. And I thought, well, if I could do this, I can do a lot with improv. And, you know, once I'd pitched that and we did the workshop, I was like, how can I do this? And I knew I had to have the timer. And the thing is, the timer has actually helped me in my own writing. So even when I'm on an assignment and I'm having trouble getting my butt in the seat, I just go, all right, just, you know, Pomodoro technique, whatever you want to call it, just let me just turn this owl's head for 20 minutes. And that's what my timer is. I'm not hurting any owls. I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to set it, and then I'm going to go. And the games are like that, too. Some of them are 15 seconds, and you kind of build your way up through the book. You know, the games start just sort of easing you into it, much like how improv should be taught, just sort of like introduction, ease into it, understand the rules, start playing, and then you get really fierce. And by the end of the book, there's a 45-minute exercise where you could write an entire one-act play.
Hmm. Yeah. And you worked with Robert McKee, and he was an improv teacher of yours?
Oh, well, he teaches story, and I had taken his workshops several times in New York. And speaking of New York, what you said about 9/11, I just wanted to...
Yes.
I just wanted to acknowledge that I actually wrote a play. I wrote a couple of plays about 9/11, and had them produced and staged in New York. One, it was very powerful. I was there, and it was a very just intense time, and the city was, I'd never experienced it like that before, obviously. And, and then I had this show. I couldn't stop writing it. It came out in prose. So it's mostly poetry, but it became a solo show, about a poet who moved, a young poet girl who moved to New York City, which I wrote so much poetry when I moved to New York City. I've never experienced this before, where I'm walking across the street and these lines are coming to me, and I'm like, I'm scribbling in my journal as I'm like, crossing the street in New York City is not a place to be scribbling, but I was, and I was just, this thing just poured out of me, And then a year later at the Neighborhood Playhouse, I wrote a one act for their, you know, for their show a year later. And I knew, I had a feeling of a lot of the shows would be, and I wrote my piece, and yeah, it was just a lot came a bit. What you said about recording history, and if we don't write it, you know, who will? And that goes for all the big moments in our mm-hmm. lives. And that was a big moment in my life. I was pretty young, and thought the world was ending, because it certainly did feel like it. And I think you take stock when things like that happen, and we're going through, there's so much happening right now too, and what's really important. And I think when you're a writer, you must write, and it's a great place to be looking for a beginning.
Yeah. Is there any way to see or read the plays that you wrote back then?
I am working on doing something. It's the solo show is called New York I Love, and I performed some of it here too, and actually internationally, a couple of different places. And I would say I'm done workshopping it, and it's time to put it out there. I've done a rehearsal for recording the audiobook. So that is the advantage of doing a lot of different things, is it's like, oh, well, I'll just figure out how to do this other thing too. Mm. So I'll let you know when that's ready.
Because, yeah, I would love to know.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually flying to New York today.
So where are you from, and when did you live in New York?
I'm from Pennsylvania, and I...
Oh, where in Pennsylvania?
Western Pennsylvania, like near Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm from Altoona.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yep. Cool, that's fun. And now we're both in California.
And when did you go to New York?
I wanted to come out here to break into animation.
Mm-hmm.
I was in New York doing lots of writing plays, and also at the same time pursuing acting, doing lots of plays as an actor, creating shows for myself, several one-woman shows and all of that. And I really just loved doing silly voices. I loved how in voiceover, like in writing, how you can be anything. You know, when I write, I become the characters, like so many authors do, and screenwriters. And I sort of transition. I think that was the acting background and the improv background. And I love the freedom in voiceover, where you could be a rock. You could be, you know, a mushroom. You could be a fairy. You could be anything. And I love that freedom. I think it's very therapeutic, actually, in writing and in voice acting, where you can completely transform and be inside another world, and then fun and entertaining for others too. So yeah, that's why I came out here. Also the sunshine.
Yeah, also the sunshine. There's that. You know, I wanted to ask you actually about narrating audiobooks, because I heard an interview with you on, what was it on? It was on Jonathan Small's Right About Now, on his podcast. Yeah. I believe that's where I heard you, and your voice was so familiar, so I had to look you up, and I realized that I heard your audio narration of Claire Vey Watkins' book, Gold Fame Citrus. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, you must have done that a long time ago, because she was on the show a long time ago with that book. And I remember listening to it, really liking the voice, because, you know, narrators can either draw you in or just send you away. I've turned mm-hmm. off audiobooks because of the narrator, and I just really liked your voice. And so, you know, a long way of asking, how does narrating audiobooks teach you about writing, or does it? Does it do anything in terms of, you know, bringing you into the craft or understanding how books work or how scenes work? Any of that?
Wow. And thank you for that. I love that I get to narrate audiobooks. It's such a treat. I mean, it's beyond that, because it's going inside a world for, you know, much like a play, but just hours and hours, days and days, sometimes weeks, being in an audiobook and embodying the characters and the emotions. And I would say narrating all these audiobooks has really helped me with writing. One of the things, actually, I mean, because when you talk with authors, that's often one of the things that's said. Just for a long time, we've been told to read, and that authors read. And I'm so fortunate that that is my job. And so I read when I prep the book, so I get to experience it that way, and then I read when I perform it. So I'm going through the material usually twice, unless it's a nonfiction. I don't always read it beforehand, but I don't do a lot of those. The other thing that has happened for me is because I'm this, so that's, I've narrated over 300 audiobooks. So I mean, if you double that for reading it, so it's, you know, it's a lot of books. And one of the neat things that has happened, and I think part of the reason that my book is in the world, is I gained a little bit of confidence of, you know, understanding some structure, and as an actor, structure, and become actor who, you know, I started writing first, but I became a professional actress first. And structure is one of those things that I didn't learn that first. I learned character and emotion. You know, I spent a lot of time on that, acting and that, and my interests. So structure isn't the thing that comes naturally to me. Reading a lot has helped me with structure, understanding journey and, you know, building and suspense and all of these different things. And, man, there's some authors out there that can do that so well. So there's a confidence in, like, reading so many books of, like, starting to understand how they kind of get put together. And it's not, writing a novel is like, whoa, a novel. But then you go, well, got to start somewhere, and all these people have done it through, you know, for all these, you know, years. So, might as well try, and that's how the book came about, and I'm sure that's how the next one will come about as well. May as well try.
Yeah, well, what you said about reading is so true, because I deal with a lot of writers, a lot of students, and when I hear someone say they don't have time to read, I've begun to say that I think reading is more important than writing, actually, in terms of progressing as a writer, because, you know, you can only do so much without being influenced by good writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, plus inspired, you know, not
inspired.
I just feel like, that's the thing, is that's a really big important part of our lives as creative people, is to find creative inspiration. And sometimes it's we write because if we don't, we think we're going to lose our mind. And I'm that person too. Writing has, I've really felt writing has saved my life. But we also write because we've got something fun we want to share, or something tickles our funny bone, and we're on the tangent, and there we go.
Yeah.
So I think not just reading, reading is very, you know, obviously very important, but if we're a little bit stuck, going to a museum and getting some visual inspiration too.
Yeah.
Things like that I just, they make our lives better, and they make us better artists.
You said it. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Georgiana Marie. Her book is Improv for Writers, 10 Secrets to Help Novelists and Screenwriters Bypass Writer's Block and Generate Infinite Ideas, published by 10 Speed Press. We have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about plotting. You talked about structure a little bit ago, and for those novelists out there who have trouble with plotting, and plotting seems to be perhaps the hardest thing for fiction writers, getting the structure, plotting it out, whether you plot in advance or as you go. What does your book do with that? What sort of exercises might someone find to help them with plotting?
there's a couple of fun ones in there. You know, different viewpoints, finding different viewpoints. But before, my first thought before, and it's like, I don't even, it's sort of the opposite with what my book is about, but it also does line up, because my first thought when you said that, and what's really helped me, is actually creating an outline. And I think that it is similar to the book in the way that an outline gives you sort of these, like, little landmarks to go by. And that's what improv does as well. Like, when I go out on stage, I have all these landmarks in terms of what the rules are, that I'm going to agree, and I'm going to provide information, I'm going to listen, I'm going to commit, I'm not going to judge things. And I think an outline can help us kind of do all of that throughout the process. I mean, even, you know, the origins of improvisation, Commedia dell'arte, they had certain things that they were going to get to, and then the rest was kind of like fly by the seat of your pants. And so I've found that sort of doing that, and then I know there are people who do not do that, and it's actually kind of a little bit of a dirty word. but even if the outline is like, you know where you're going at the end, and then being free enough to let the characters take you somewhere, and all of that, you know, let follow them, because they're often guiding us to something really cool, or we think the scene is going to be about something, and then we flip it on it in the moment. In writing, it gets flipped on its end, and it's a completely different thing, just in terms of where we thought that scene was going to end. And I think that's, again, where reading comes into play. You know, structure can be kind of innate in us as we're going along. So trusting that we will be able to build something, and having that trust, because if you read enough, you know things are going to happen. You're building towards something, and this is just part of who you are as a writer and your experience in the world, and knowing that the structure will be there, and then you can go back and edit and tighten things and go in and add something, or you can use that outline or not, or whatever. But I think trust is a really big part of that.
Yeah, and I love that, because I used to be sort of a seat of the pants writer, and more I find that what I write works best if I do have some idea of where I'm going. It's so true.
It has changed my writing, but I don't want to tell people, you know, how to go about doing this, because we all work in different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in this book, I recorded the nonfiction book, obviously. I recorded the audio book, and just by going over that material again and being in the studio and like in this very creative environment, I was directed by a friend of mine. That day I left, my brain could not stop working. I was like, what about this game? Oh, and I want to share that game. And oh, and I just invented this game. And I just, everything was kind of rolling. And that's what happens when we just immerse ourselves. So I think, you know, if we're having, like, you know, problems with, you know, issues with structure, it's like issues with anything else. Like, just getting in there and continuing to write, and, you know, trying a new angle. I think the book is good for that. It says it in the title about bypassing, you know, bypassing writer's block, generating. The bypass is a really important aspect of this book, because it's a different way of working. I'm not writing some, you know, this is how you write. I wouldn't dare. But I am saying, like, this is a cool thing that has worked for so many people, to, like, come up with an idea in a split second, and you can do it too. And you're going to come up with stuff that will surprise and amaze yourself, because I see that constantly with students. They, you know, we set the time, and I've done it at the book events too, and had people share it. And it's just like, it's really glorious. We did that in mere seconds.
Yeah.
Mere seconds.
It's really, it's really amazing.
It can happen.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I think your book would be a lovely one to listen to, as well as read on the page and have it to mark up and all that. And I so appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, Barbara, thank you. This was really nice. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Georgiana Marie. Her book is Improv for Writers. We will be right back with Helen Phillips. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Oh, I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. My name is Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I've been here since the top of the hour. If you're just tuning in, you can subscribe to Writers on Writing on iTunes or Stitcher. And when we podcast the show, you can hear it from the start. And at the top of the hour, we talked a bit about 9/11, and this is the 18th anniversary. Keep counting the years because it doesn't seem possible. But I also said if we had time, I wanted to read a short poem. And I'm going to. And it's by Pulitzer Prize winning poet, one of my favorites, Stephen Dunn. And he's been on the show a couple of times and may come on with his new collection. But this morning I spent quite a while looking at poems, reading poems online that were written after 9/11, and I came across this one, and I want to read it to you. It's called Grudges by Stephen Dunn. Easy for almost anything to occur. Even if we've scraped the sky, we can be rubble. For years those men felt one way, acted another. Ground zero, is it possible to get lower? Now we had a new definition of the personal, new almost anything could occur. It just takes a little training to blur a motive, lie low while planning the terrible. Get good at acting one way, feeling another. Yet, who among us doesn't harbor a grudge or secret? So much isn't erasable. It follows that almost anything can occur. Like men ascending into the democracy of air without intending to land, the useful veil of having said one thing, meaning another. Before you know it, something's over. Suddenly, someone's missing at the table. It's easy, I know it, for anything to occur. When men feel one way, act another. That was Stephen Dunn. And if you Google Grudges by Stephen Dunn, you'll find it. It's a good day to read poetry, read, write, all of that. And now we have our next guest, Helen Phillips. Helen is the author of most recently the novel The Need, which is what she's here to talk about today. Her collection, Some Possible Solutions, received the 2017 John Gardner Fiction Book Award. Her novel, The Beautiful Bureaucrat, a New York Times notable book of 2015, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and the New York Public Library Young Lions Award. Her collection, And Yet They Were Happy, was named a notable collection by the Story Prize. She's also the author of the middle grade novel, Here Where the Sunbeams Are Green. Helen has received a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and the Italo Calvino Prize in Fabulous Fiction, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Tin House, and on selected shorts. She's an associate professor at Brooklyn College, lives in Brooklyn with her husband and their children. She has a website, helencphillips.com. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. Let's begin by talking about The Need and how the book came about.
So there are two points of genesis for the book. Well, there are 1,000 points of genesis, but there are two distinct ones that I can discuss today. One of those moments was it was a moment when my daughter was newborn and I was home alone with her. My husband was just out for a few hours in the evening and I thought I heard footsteps in the other room, and I was naked nursing her on the bed, and I had this flash of fear. Oh, what would I do if there was an intruder in the house? Really, what would I do? And it was nothing. It was just some sound that your apartment makes sometimes. But that flash of instinctual fear I had of being home alone with this vulnerable person who I wanted to protect really stayed with me. And I thought, I have to write about this sensation. And then years later, that very emotion became the beginning of The Need, and that scenario became the beginning of The Need. And then the other impetus for the book was that same summer that my daughter was born, my older sister died. So just as I was falling in love with my child and diving into the intensity and the joy of having a newborn, my family was mourning the loss of my parents' firstborn child. And so the book is really about what it's like when mothers are in very different circumstances, and how do you hold both the love and the grief at the same time.
Mm. Well, why don't we start by having you read for a couple of minutes. Would you do that?
Yes, I would love to. And I actually will read from the very scene I mentioned, the first scene of the book. Because since it is a mystery of sorts, it's hard to read from anywhere else aside from the beginning. So I'll start right from the beginning.
Okay.
Chapter 1 of The Need. She crouched in front of the mirror in the dark, clinging to them. The baby in her right arm, the child in her left. There were footsteps in the other room. She had heard them an instant ago. She had switched off the light, scooped up her son, pulled her daughter across the bedroom to hide in the far corner. She had heard footsteps, but she was sometimes hearing things, a passing ambulance mistaken for Ben's nighttime wail, the moaning hinges of the bathroom cabinet mistaken for Viv's impatient pre-tantrum sigh. Her heart and blood were loud. She needed them to not be so loud. Another step,
Or was it a soft hiccup from Ben? Or was it her own knee joint cracking beneath 36 pounds of Viv? She guessed the intruder was in the middle of the living room now, halfway to the bedroom. She knew there was no intruder. Viv smiled at her in the feeble light of the faraway street lamp. Viv always craved games that were slightly frightening. Any second now, she would demand the next move in this wondrous new one. Her desperation for her children's silence manifested as a suffocating force, the desire for a pillow, a pair of thick socks, anything she could shove into them to perfect their muteness and save their lives. Another step, hesitant but undeniable. Or maybe not. Ben was drowsy, tranquil, his thumb in his mouth. Viv was looking at her with curious, cunning eyes. David was on a plane somewhere over another continent. The babysitter had marched off to get a Friday night beer with her girls. Could she squeeze the children under the bed and go out to confront the intruder on her own? Could she press them into the closet, keep them safe among her shoes? And I'll stop there. On a bit of a cliffhanger.
Great. Thank you. That was Helen Phillips reading from The Need, published by Simon & Schuster. I was curious, earlier you said, you talked about the idea coming to you, and I'm wondering if you made notes back then, or do you make notes for, you know, ideas you have for current project or future project, or do you feel that if it's important, you'll remember?
I worry that I won't remember, given all the things that are on my mind. So I do make notes. And in fact, the two inciting incidents for the book that I described to you took place in 2012, but I didn't really start to write the book until 2016. But starting with that image and others, those images, I began this enormous list. So my first step of writing a novel is always just to keep a huge list of running things of images and ideas and newspaper article clippings and overheard dialogue and snippets from dreams I had. Just anything I can throw into that document, as long as I feel like it's somehow related to this book that I will eventually someday make. So that process usually takes me about 2 years or more of just making an enormous list. And out of that, I will then weave that together and figure out a plot. But it's all about the note-taking for me in the early stages.
So I imagine, since you are so prolific, that you are also working on another book while you're making these notes.
Yes, I like to keep that running list because it takes so long to create it, and because time is an important ingredient of the brainstorming process, I always have that running alongside whatever else is going on in my life. So while I was working on The Need, I had that document running for another book of mine. But I would sometimes go 3 weeks without adding to that document, and then 3 days in a row I would add a bunch to it. So it's very random, and I just accept it being random. I really like having a first stage of writing that is extremely low stakes and low pressure. I think for me that helps with my creativity. So I like having a document where I can throw anything and I'm not really thinking about what the end result will be. I think you need to lull yourself into feeling like the stakes are low, and then you can be more playful.
Yeah. And just trusting. It sounds like you have to some degree, trust the process of letting it unfold.
Yes. And just someday I'll figure that out. For now, I'm not going to figure it out, but I have this instinct that this image will be somewhere in this book someday.
Yeah, interesting. So the structure, I found the structure really interesting because, you know, it's, I guess, would you call it a braided narrative?
Oh, I've never used that term for it, but certainly that's a very good description for the first 60 pages of the book.
Yeah, because you really delay finding out, is there an intruder? Is she imagining things? Who is this intruder? And so I found that structure just really compelling because, you know, the first chapter is from what you read, where is there someone there? And then we're somewhere else. We're in the past during her job. And then we're back in that room. Talk about coming up with that structure for that beginning, the first part of the book.
Yeah, well, I really wanted the beginning of the book to have a really intense forward momentum and suspense. One reason is because I find it really fun to read books that have that, where every chapter ends with a question or some kind of cliffhanger. That I think that's a very dynamic reading experience. Another reason I structured it that way is because I could only stay with the mother and her fear and the children for so long. I needed a break from that in those early pages, and I think the reader does too. You need a little space from the intensity of that scenario. And also, the reason I set up the beginning of the book to read like a thriller, and I wouldn't exactly call the book overall a thriller, but it has thriller elements, and especially at the beginning. And part of the reason for that is, this is a bit of a joke, but having young children sometimes feels a little bit like that. Like, there's just a lot of urgent things. They're not, probably not life-threatening, but, oh, there's pasta water on the stove, and the baby needs their diaper changed, and someone is about to have an accident in their undies. And you just have this feeling, and then you have a work email that you really need to respond to. So that feeling of juggling has a certain intensity and suspense to it. And I was trying to capture some of that in the opening, too. So there were a lot of things I was thinking about as I crafted the momentum of those early pages.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about genre, because it very much is a literary novel. And yet, you know, there are these thriller elements. And I was curious if you think genre. Are you thinking genre when you write, or are you letting the story unfold as it will?
I was thinking about genre to some degree. It has elements of thriller. It has elements of science fiction or speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. Since it was published, people have called it horror, which I truly didn't think of the entire time I was writing it, which in retrospect is maybe kind of odd that I didn't think of that. but a lot of people have noticed horror elements in it. And then I've also heard ghost story as another description of it. So, I'm very concerned with language, so I guess that's maybe why you said it reads like a literary book. I certainly have a concern for writing really thoughtful sentences and thinking a lot about language, but I also really enjoy borrowing elements of genre, and the reason for that in this case is because what I needed and wanted to express in this book, I am not able to express that just through realism. A different kind of writer could do that just through realism. But for me, in order to make these metaphors concrete, in order to bring life to this particular set of concerns about motherhood and loss, I needed to have the thriller-like pacing to give you a sense of dread. I needed to have this perfect nemesis arise out of the cosmic abyss in this sort of speculative scenario in order to truly grapple with these things. Using those elements are a way of making concrete these ideas that are hard for me to get at otherwise. So I felt like I was borrowing from genre to help me. I was using whatever I could to get where I needed to go.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, the novel, the writing has been compared to Italo Calvino, who I've been a fan of for years and years, and you've won the Calvino Prize in Fabulous Fiction, and so you must be a fan of his work. Is that so?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I mean, these days, I don't know, he's not read enough, perhaps.
In my classes, he's read enough. Well, maybe not enough, but I do assign his work a lot. And one thing I love about him is he will create a fantastical scenario of some kind, but it's all in the interest of deepening our understanding of our own day-to-day mundane lives. And so I love the way his work is at once otherworldly and yet so relevant and targeted to daily concerns.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if you could talk about a section that was perhaps hard for you for whatever reason to write, maybe read a paragraph and talk about how you dealt with it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I just to set up this section a little bit, this is, so, a little bit of a spoiler, but there is, in fact, an intruder, and I'm going to read from this section the first moment where they actually see the intruder, and the intruder is wearing a mask, a golden deer mask, that Molly's husband had made her for her birthday.
Okay.
The deer held the Y book out to Viv like an offering. The Y book is a book that the child has lost and has been looking for a long time. The deer held the Y book out to Viv like an offering. Viv stopped mid-step, hesitating, as though jerked backward by a magical thread, the thread of Molly's love, the umbilical cord tugging the child toward the mother, holding her back at the edge of the cliff. She glanced at Molly, her eyes wide and glistening, and Molly thought, yes, that's right, don't go, stay close. But just as she thought it, just as she breathed out with thankfulness for the fact that Viv, very nearly four, had the sense not to run toward a masked stranger, the thread snapped, and Viv sprinted forward to snatch the book out of the deer's hand.
Hmm.
And so that usually when I revise, I'm cutting sentences and cutting words. My second draft is always shorter than my first draft. But this was one case where I actually had to add language and add sentences because my editor, Mary Sue Rucci of Simon & Schuster, in the original, she made a very insightful comment. So in the original draft, the deer, this masked intruder, holds the book out to the child, and the child just runs and gets it. And so that was a very brief moment. She ran to the deer to get the book. But those additional sentences where she hesitates, and the mother feels like, okay, it's going to be fine. She's going to stay close to me. And then she breaks that connection. I needed to linger in that moment. There is so much suspense there. There's so much about the relationship between the mother and the child. And I had not done that in the draft that my editor had read. And so she said, I think we need more sentences here. And I thought it was such a helpful edit. And part of the reason I think I hadn't written those sentences is because it's such a scary part of the book that I almost didn't want, you don't want to dwell in that moment. I mean, it's a moment of high tension, but those moments are the moments where you actually most need to linger and explore a little bit. So I was very, though it was challenging, I was glad to be able to find the language there.
Mm. Yeah, and those moments often, I wonder, are they moments sometimes that as a writer you don't want to have to think about, or are you so close to the material that it just escapes you, that you don't see it?
Well, I think it can be either, but with all of the revisions for this book in particular, in my past writings, this is my fifth book, so I've written a number of books, and in the past, my experience of revision has been that I need to figure out a craft question or a character question as my central revision challenge. But for this book, my central revision challenge was really an emotional one of some of the revision I had to do required me to go to challenging emotional places, like this scene where I have to have the child lingering for a moment before running to the masked stranger, moments where I had to really grapple with certain emotions that the characters were feeling that were scary for me, that were uncomfortable for me, that really were connected to my own loss of my sisters. So it was interesting to encounter revision challenges that were more of the emotional sort than the craft sort. And it was a powerful experience. I think I grew from writing this book, but it was unlike anything I had ever experienced before as a revising writer.
Hmm. Do you live with your characters? Do they talk to you? Do you need to know so much about them and their past before you begin writing?
I'm always fascinated when writers say that their characters speak to them and that they know their entire backstory. It's not that way for me. I am often interested in what's the bare minimum you can tell people about your characters and still have them filled with life. So I'm less interested in the whole history of Molly's entire life and her childhood and everything. I like to just arrive with her in the present moment and believe that all of that other stuff is implied in what she does in the scenes before our eyes. So when I'm working on a book, it feels like I'm spending part of my time in my daily life and then part of my time in the world of the book. So it does come very much to life for me, but it's not quite like the characters are talking to me. Yeah, so that would be awesome. I hope it happens to me someday.
I know. I find that interesting, too, when writers say, yeah, she started talking to me. I'm like, I don't think they've ever talked to me.
Not me. Maybe someday.
So we have just a couple of minutes left, and I'm curious if you have other influences other than Calvino. Were there other writers? Were there teachers? Are there writers in your past, people in your past that you remember advice they gave you or things you learned from them?
There are so many different sources of that. But in terms of books that really influenced me, there's a book called Fever Dream by Samantha Schweblin. She's an Argentine writer, so it was actually translated into English. It's a very slim book, but it's about a woman and her daughter and this kind of infected region where they are spending the summer. And as the book goes on, you learn more and more about, well, you actually don't learn that much, but it becomes more eerier and eerier in terms of what's going on in this particular place. And that book just strikes this incredible balance of suspense and forward motion while also asking really deep questions about the mother-child bond and about I also think it's about climate change as well. So that is one book that I just can't recommend highly enough. And certainly Kafka is always present for me, and Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler I love and think about a lot. Too many to name. But that's a sampling.
And before we go, any advice for the novelists who are listening?
Two quotes that run through my head all the time, and one is from Toni Morrison. I'm sad she's no longer with us, but a failure is just information. She said a failure is just information. And I think carrying that with you as a writer, because you're going to fail a lot as a writer. You're going to not get it down on the page the way you want it to. You're going to get rejected from different literary magazines and stuff. And just to think of failure as information, I think is a very beautiful way to look at failure. And then Isaac Dennison said, I write every day, a little bit every day, without hope and without despair. Mm. And I like that idea of entering your writing time without hope, without despair. It's just something you do every day. So those are two that I cling to and think about a lot.
Mm. I love both of those. The first, Toni Morrison's, reminded me of, I think it's a Beckett. Is it a Beckett quote?
Fail better. Again, fail better.
Yeah, fail again, fail better.
Yeah, those are my two failure quotes. And they're both really, really helpful. And it just, I don't know, in general, as a teacher too, you sometimes make mistakes, you sometimes fail, and that is conceiving of that as information, yeah, as a way to become better is it's a helpful way to look at it.
Mm. Helen Phillips, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Of course.
That was Helen Phillips. Her novel is The Need, published by Simon and Schuster. That's all the time we have today. I hope you all have a good writing week, and we'll be back here next week. So mark your calendar, subscribe to iTunes, Writers on Writing at iTunes, and have a great week.